Council meeting for Tuesday, November 12th, 2019, 9 a.m. is hereby called to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to council today. If you have electronics, please turn them to the silent mode. Under changes, approval of agenda, I have one change to the agenda. Item 15.2 under in camera will be removed. 15.2 in camera, please remove. Are there any other changes to the agenda that circulate? A motion to approve the agenda as amended would be in order. Moved by Deputy Mayor Kelly, seconded by Tuesday Councilor McLeod. Any discussion? Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of the motion? Thank you. Under 3.0 presentations, we have 3.1, the RCMP report this morning. Staff Sergeant Dan Archibald is here, if you'd like to come forward.
Good day, folks. How's everybody doing?
Great, thanks.
Good. Good morning. So I understand you all have a very jam-packed schedule today. Unfortunately, I wanted to stay up here and ramble on and on, but I won't be able to do that. It's too bad. So I'll just go over a few things. The last time I spoke to you, I believe, was in May. So it's been a little while, but back then we were looking for resources. It was kind of a bigger issue, and I could say that we are absolutely fully staffed. I should whisper that because we're one of the very few in all of Nova Scotia that are fully staffed. So a few new members we have in is a significant one would be a corporal or operations NCO, Corporal Rob Frizzell. He came from the Northwest Territories, so having two non-commissioned officers, supervisors at the detachment sure is helpful. Mm-hmm. We've got Constable Vladimir Dunin, who came in from Lunenburg, and as some of you may know, we have Constable Steve Murphy is here as well, back in Queens County. So some files of interest that we've had since I last spoke to you, some things that we've been doing. I'll just read off quickly here some of the things. So on July 31st, this past summer, so RCMP members from Queens County, PDS, Police Dog Service out of Lunenburg County, our emergency response team, along with South Shore Integrated Street Crime Enforcement Unit. They're also based at Lunenburg. We executed a warrant on 74 Brunswick Street here in Liverpool. Three individuals were arrested. That was in regards to drug trafficking. Some items seized were 15 grams of crack cocaine, 67 methamphetamine pills, or ice pills as they're called nowadays, 29 pills of Ritalin, some cannabis edibles, along with some other various evidence of trafficking were seized, and those individuals were remanded into custody without major incident. It was just, from my perspective, coming from different divisions, being in Queens County and having at your fingertips, we met at a outside location. We're trying to be discreet about it. We had, I would say, 20 emergency response team members with the big armored vehicle. We had seven street crime enforcement plainclothes members. We had about 8 to 10 members from the detachment. I've never been a part of anything like that in my life, where you had so many resources at your fingertips, and just that sense of security when you're executing that warrant. And it was really nice to see where, like, 13 years ago when I executed a warrant like that, it was me and two other members kicking on a door up in northern Manitoba. We've come a long way, leaps and bounds, and it was very reassuring. So those individuals who are charged are still before the courts, still waiting a disposition on that. On August 9th, we've got lots of different things, guys. Some things of interest I just thought I'd bring forward to you. So on August 9th, we responded to a single vehicle MVC on Highway 103 near Port Mattoon. EHS was already on scene when we arrived. The complainant had called it in, and what we had there was basically the vehicle had skidded off the road at the single lane portion of that highway and entered the ditch. The individual driver was deceased at the time of arrival, and we believe alcohol was a factor, so in the event. Another file of interest would be just this past weekend, for instance, we had an incident in Queens County where somebody's house was, I guess you might even call it it was a mischief. The windows were being smashed out of this house. The individual responded by firing a firearm into the front of the vehicle. So we responded to that. That took us basically all weekend to investigate. We had street crime enforcement members came out again from Lunenburg. So they're based out of Lunenburg, but these members, plainclothes, are able to help us. Like, they drafted the warrants for the residents for the car. They assisted in the statement taking, all these things. So it's not just the members here in Queens County. We're able to reach out to those different units, which is what I noticed coming to this division, which is great. So one individual was charged in that incident, and the investigation's ongoing. Yearly statistics, guys, I'll just, they're broken down for those of you who have this this agenda here. Biggest thing, impaired drivers. This year we've gotten 11 charges thus far, which is far more than last year. I don't think they're on the rise. I think they're just being enforced more. This has to do with the not only the amount of members we have working, but the individuals that we have. Some people are passionate about it more than others, and they're out looking for them on a nightly, daily basis. So check stops we've increased this year. We're you may or may not be seeing them. They are primarily at nighttime hours. I know myself, I'm not out at 10 o'clock at night very often, but that's primarily when they're happening. So we've done 30 of those so far this year. It's something we're tracking. They've never really been tracked before. So we're trying to increase them, which we've already increased from last year. Number of tickets issued. As of last week, we've issued just under 200 tickets, primarily speeding tickets, so 54 of those. Traffic control devices I know are kind of hot in Queens County. We've given 33 of those. Those are stop signs and street lights and unregistered vehicles, uninsured vehicles, some of the other ones we've been given. I won't go over all of them, but number of warnings issued as well are 115, so we're not just out charging drivers. We're trying to educate as well and giving, you know, almost just as many breaks and warnings. So calls for service, so far as of last week, we've responded to 1,683 incidences that were reported. Some of those criminal code instances are broken down here. So 77 would be crimes against persons. Those would be assaults, uttering threats, and harassments are 95 of those. So those are primarily a big intake of our call volume. Sexual assaults, there were 6 reported. Thefts and possession of stolen property, we've got 65 of those. Mischiefs are a big one. Mischiefs could be anything from somebody's on my property, or mischief could be an incident where somebody just makes a report they're not liking an individual doing something at their residence. Mischief, right? Mental Health Act is also a big one we respond to. 48 of those calls were that falls under the Mental Health Act, and it's not a criminal code matter, but we still have to respond to those ones. So you can see the breakdown there, guys. I won't go through it all. We've lodged 72 prisoners this year, which is a little higher than previous years. I think last year we had 40. So I think the biggest thing with that is we're actually using our cell blocks. A lot of times we transfer them into Bridgewater because we couldn't find a guard or matron. We have two reliable ones now, so we're using our cells, which is good to see. So our curfew checks, almost done here, guys. Curfew checks are something that we started doing at the start of the year. Basically, if offenders released and placed on court order conditions with a curfew or a house arrest, in previous years they weren't often being looked after. They'd be released on that condition, and we didn't have the resources to go check them. Now we're checking them. So we've done 80 thus far this year, and we've charged multiple offenders for not abiding by the curfew, which helps. Anybody who comes into our area from outside of Queens region, probation office often notifies us, so we're aware that they're even here, which is nice. So that's all I've got so far, guys. There's a community policing report and a senior safety report there. I won't speak on that. Our community policing officer is very active in the community, Constable Ron Duffney. He took over just before I arrived here this past April. He's doing a phenomenal job, I'm hearing, especially as you compare him to previous community policing officers. I've been told he's doing a very fantastic job. He's out in the schools, he's out at every event. Senior safety, I won't speak on what Shelley Walker's been doing. She could, if you guys ever, of course, need to speak to Shelley, by all means, but she's been flat out, is the best way to describe it. She's been go, go, go. And it's very beneficial program. She helps us in our investigations as well, just by being that person in that position. So that's it. Sorry if I rushed or if I was talking too fast there.
Deputy Mayor Kelly, I believe you have an issue to raise under the community report.
I just wanted to let everybody know that this past Friday, there were two fire alarms. They were both in District 2 in my district on King Street. Oddly enough, two fires on King Street on Friday. And I just wanted to make people aware that one was a young family, two kids, and one is still like 3 months old. They're now staying in a hotel right for the time being. They were when I last spoke to them on Saturday. And that they need lots of items, especially for kids. So I wanted to put it out there that the other couple as well is staying with friends, but they, and while their repairs are being done on their home, they're looking for a furnished place for 3 to 4 months. If anybody is aware of anything for these two families that can help them, that would be great. Thank you very much. I just wanted to bring that up for everybody to let them know if there's anything that they can add to that. Thank you for allowing that.
Any other counselor? Counselor Crowley?
I'm surprised, but yet not surprised, with the number of mental health calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering how, we all know there's a real issue with mental health help in South Shore and Nova Scotia. Do you find that a lot? Do you find it frustrating that more, or is it getting better for you guys?
I would say it's getting better. But do you mean the amount of mental health calls or the services what? For them?
Yeah, once you get a call, what you can do to follow up on it. That's been the challenge in the past.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the services are out there. Unfortunately, the reality of it is a lot of the mental health calls that we get would be the same repeated individuals a lot of times. And it's hard when a lot of those individuals have tried every avenue and they're going through the right process, but sometimes it isn't enough. It's frustrating for us as law enforcement, but it must be more frustrating for that individual themselves. And it's real, and it's something that is on the rise. It's being recognized now, which is good. But there are the proper services within, here in the city. For you do have to be able to get to those resources, and we do. That's where we kind of come in, and we've got the services we can offer to them, but
So you're, just to follow up on that a little bit, so when you get a call, you're not just going and dealing with that, but is there a second step for you guys? Like, do you take them to Bridgewater, or do you go to the next step?
Yeah, like, someone well, else? Yes, we'll take it. Our mandate or our policies are basically we have to get them to a physician for either a voluntary or an involuntary assessment by a physician, and the physician dictates where they go from there, whether or not there's further treatment. So that's our initial response, and it is primarily in the hands of others once we deal with it and ensure their initial safety.
Any other counselor have a question or comment? Deputy Mayor Kelly?
I've said it many, many, many times before. I appreciate everything that the RCMP are doing about the traffic. And it was great to see the report like this, because people can see that you are out there actually giving speeding tickets and doing check stops. Something that happened not last week, but the week before, I had just been that day to visit a new couple, a family that had just moved to Liverpool on Main Street. And first in the door, it was what can you do about the traffic? What, because they get them speeding up and down.
Yeah.
Because when they do the loop, and every once in a while they get bored, and then they just go up Main Street around the fire hall, right? So they live right on that stretch there. So they're getting like the revving of the engines and the really loud motorcycles and all of that. So it was fresh in my mind then, when I was on Main Street and saw the same car going around and around and speeding and squealing its tires and everything. So I phoned the RCMP. They had a vehicle in the area, so they sent it down. So I quickly saw the the RCMP car drive down, and then they called me back after and said that they pulled them over, they had a chat with them about the speeding and didn't hear anymore after that. I mean, everybody understands the challenges. As soon as the police come into town, it's everywhere. Whenever it's a stop check or check stop, it goes everywhere saying about the police are around, so you don't hear it. So it's really, really difficult. I do understand that.
Yeah.
I do appreciate you coming out, and I encourage everyone to call.
Yeah.
Put those calls in. It gives you the opportunity to pull that car over at any time in the future if you're aware of a call about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Heather. And that's exactly it. If anyone sees something happening, who knows where an officer might be. They might be able to get there right away.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is, though, we're not going to be everywhere at once, and we're not going to often be able to get out and do traffic enforcement. Like this weekend, we were so invested in this incident with the shooting that, yeah, there was probably very minimal traffic enforcement being done this weekend because we were all hands were on deck focusing on this. This individual has to be before a judge in 24 hours. There's a lot of pressure put on resources. That's the way it is. We can't always be there, but if somebody's willing to report it as it's happening, huge. So that's good. Glad to hear.
Councilor McLeod?
Nice to meet you, finally. I was away in May, so I didn't get a chance. And yesterday was a very nice Remembrance Day service.
It was.
And the Legion, of course, always have a great banquet. It's really good to see the community out and to have your presence here as well in the world. The community policing report, I read that, and it's interesting to know that we have a very active community policing officer, Constable Duffy. And I'm interested in this youth advisory committee that he, I think, has established at the high school. So it would be interesting. I'd like to chat with him sometime about that.
Yes. And if anyone would like to have Constable Duffy join me at any time at one of these meetings, every time? I'll bring him in every time.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Sure, he would love that.
And I'm interested also in, there's a lot of issues in our community, in every community, about bullying, and I know that's a topic that really needs a little bit more discussion on and how we can deal with those issues, because it's affecting youth and it's affecting the families and the school system
for
as well.
Sure.
So maybe that could be a topic that we could highlight at some point.
Yes. And the province does a great job in training these community policing officers in all those areas so they can go out into those schools with some knowledge on it. And like Constable Duffy is new to it. He only started in March, I believe. So he's been getting the training that he needs for that position, which is beneficial. So thank you very much.
Any other councilor have a question or comment? Councilor Fancy?
Yes, along with the speeding issue, I call it. I think in particular, I live up in West Street in Milton. There's no sidewalks.
Mm.
And of course, if they don't cut back the grass, then you're walking on the road all the time, and you would expect you to go around the corner, up that one spot there where the railing is. You're very, a lot of times you have to step off the side when cars are coming, and they're using quite a bit for a speedway.
Yeah.
We go walking along, and I just keep saying to people, slow down when they come. They're whipping it in a bit, and it's too late to make the change when they're up beside you. Even
yeah.
if you're not going too fast, it can be a matter of there's no room for the two cars and people and everything else. I guess
yeah.
It's becoming becoming aware that they even if going at the right speed, meeting pedestrians is an issue.
Yes, and that's something we get those calls from various areas in the region. Like another one that sparks my memory for that one is just last week. Somebody had called about the new section of road on the name slips my mind, just after the that hotel in Brooklyn, Trans Scotia. That new paved portion there, people are kind of speeding through there. So the speed trailer that we share with Lunenburg County, I've requested that, so that's something we have to pick up this week actually and get it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put it in that area initially, the new paved portion, because we have received a few complaints about that. And like you said, the biggest thing is probably people not realizing how fast they're actually going until they see it. And like it's more of an education thing. It's not going to actually ticket people, but it does tend to catch your eye and, oh yeah, you are going too fast for this section. So that's something we can look at putting there as well, if there's room for the trailer to go in that narrow area or around there. So.
Well, it can be. You can go up further up there, but there's a spot down by the water.
That might be a good spot for it, yeah.
Just to be able to let people know.
Yes.
That's the other part I was going to ask you, Bill, because we were sharing that with Lindenberg, but we haven't been getting it up here a whole lot. Right?
No, I think we only had it once for a couple weeks this past summer. We had it out by Somerville area. Hunts Point. So we can try and definitely get that whenever it's not in use. I know Lunenburg uses it a lot in Bridgewater. Sorry, it's actually Bridgewater Police's, they share it with us, and they use it a lot for the school zones there in Bridgewater. So whenever it's free, we'll definitely try and get it as often as we can.
I wonder along with that if we could be able to, I don't know if you guys do things like that, but the issue of some things like, say, it's coming all winter time, it's getting dark early at night. People walking on the road, make sure you have your
reflective
things, and be cognizant that even if you're not speeding, there's people walking.
Yes, yeah, that's something we can definitely do. It's just a quick news release, yeah.
Okay,
for sure.
Councilor Johnson,
very positive report, Dan. Thank you very much. I just want to say that from the senior safety perspective, the support and the information that you folks and your officers have put forward to say how valuable that service is helping us do tremendous good things with that position. Mm-hmm. And Shelley's doing a great job.
She is.
And from a community perspective, having the extra exposure of Dave and George in the area and here in California, it's just, even if they're just passing through with the car or whatever,
yeah,
it makes all the difference in the world. And if you got an extra day or two on that speed trailer, maybe we could put one in Dave's neighborhood up here in Kemp, because that's a huge issue over that hill there.
100%, yeah. It's that beneficial. It's something that, and you know what, if it's been a while and you think maybe I need a reminder, sometimes a reminder sure does help me get myself in gear. So definitely, that's something
Thank
we can look at.
Much,
Caledonia, just, I guess I could mention, I was speaking to the mayor yesterday at the Remembrance Day ceremonies. I'm going to try and look at getting the musical ride in the area in 2020. They're coming to Nova Scotia, so I've applied for that. Just waiting to hear back if that works out. So. That'll be good for the Caledonia area as well, yeah.
Yes, I have Councilor Philip next.
We've had a real issue down at the throughway stop in front of the post office, and I've talked about it many times, but one of the motions that came out of the last conversation was that we would up the police presence there, mm-hmm, and try to educate people and let people know that, you know, there's obviously some challenges there.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any plan or any action on that?
Well, we have increased enforcement there as best we can over the past month, speaking with council, and we have issued several tickets as well as warnings to both pedestrians and vehicular traffic. It is a hard area to find that occurring. Like I was saying, it often involves two officers. You need an officer in a vehicle ready to go to catch the vehicle that ran the stop sign or failed to yield. But you can't park there and view it in a PC, in a police vehicle, because you're a huge pylon. Everyone sees you, and okay, let's abide by the rules. So it is a harder area to enforce in that way. Educate's huge. Like, I think we basically gave the public a warning that we were going to start doing it, and I think in doing that probably did more than actually the enforcement of it. Was just be aware that if you get a ticket, this is why. Like, we are enforcing it. So that's kind of where we are with that stop. The traffic authority, Corporal Harris, is reaching out to other regions and trying to establish what can be done there, if anything. Whether it be, I know the other day, just in talking to him, he was, maybe I shouldn't mention it, but talked about what if removing one of those crosswalks was beneficial to the overall three-way. I think the crosswalk he was speaking, something we could talk about later, but the crosswalk he mentioned would be the one going from the post office to the bakery, just to narrow.
Oh.
So, yeah, I know. It's complicated. We're trying to figure out what would be the best way to do that to it's, I've been there many a time and people put their head down a lot of times and they're just walking into that into that intersection. And it's
so
works both ways.
We're also looking at some different options, but I just wanted to know that this enforcement is not just a one-time thing, that it's going to continue on, because many times, you know, if we reach out for enforcement, it's just a one-time thing, and
yeah,
we know at that particular spot, that's yeah, not going to work. It has to be ongoing, and people have to be aware that you are monitoring it.
Yes. Oh, we are, and I could tell you, every member at the office knows, like, about that three-way intersection and how it's a hot topic here in council. It is. You folks all hear about it from the public, and it's not like it's something new. So everyone is aware of it at the office, and they know when they're down in that area to, if it's possible, enforce it, right? We'll continue that.
Thank you.
Councilor Fisk?
I just want to bring to your attention that Queens County Fairgrounds is a prime location for the RCMP, and the area will certainly appreciate the
That's the fairgrounds was where they had it years back.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's the location that we would be, yeah, be looking at. Yeah. Yeah. I received a call or an email about it a few months back, of the musical ride coming to H Divi- or Nova Scotia H Division, and my brother was a member of the ride for 4 years, and I called him quick. I said, "What does this entail? Is this something I should be looking at?" And he just encouraged it big time. And so it's something that I hopefully it works out and we can get that here. So.
It's just a proper location in the accommodation for the animals.
Yes. Yep, that's the area we'd be looking at. Yep.
Councilor McLeod?
Reference to Councilor Frelick's comments and concern about the intersection by the post office freeway. When I was and I was in London years ago, and traffic, of course, in those big cities is. But they had painted on the sidewalk, on the street, when you were stopping at mm-hmm. the curve, is they had look both ways or whatever traffic, and it was almost like it made you look up, make sure that you knew that you had to be aware that you should be, you know, looking both ways.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would work with us. It was something that was painted on the pavement for the winter months and that sort of thing with the snow, but that seemed to really be helpful for people to be aware and to look rather than walk across the street with their heads down.
Yeah, just something to catch your attention.
Yeah.
And it was paint. It was painted
yeah.
on, so
yeah.
something pretty
just
cost
like,
effective
just like
too.
The, crosswalk.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. that might be beneficial as well. It is what it is. It's an old town. Streets are narrow, and it's a beautiful town, beautiful section of town. You get all the old stores and business fronts, but that's just the name of the game there in that area. So, something we'll continue to work on and.
Any other councillor have a question or comment? Well, thank you, Staff Sergeant Archibald.
Thank
for
you.
An interesting presentation.
All righty. Thanks a lot, everyone. See you again soon.
Under 3.2, we have a Liverpool flood mitigation study presentation by representatives of CBCL, and I would ask if perhaps you would come to the presentation desk.
That's running all kind of I can get things started as well here, making sure everything's working.
Sure.
How's everyone today? Good. A few familiar faces. I think I was here, was it March or so, to talk about the first part of this. My name's Colin Fisher with CBCL Engineering. This is Sevier Personani. He's going to help me here today. You know, I wanted to take a minute to say thank you to the municipality and the town for allowing us to work in your community for a long time. You know, through this project, we've had a chance to visit some old pieces of work that we've done, stormwater study from the early 90s, some drawings for for that lower parking lot area in downtown, and some other things. And as an engineer, it's nice to be able to have a look at what you've done in the past collectively, you know, see how it's worked, how it hasn't worked, and everybody gets a chance to learn from it, get a chance to come back and hopefully improve on things. But today we're going to talk about climate change and its impacts. Obviously, it's a big challenge that Nova Scotia is dealing with right now. As a company, we've done a lot of work in this area over the past several years, and there's no shortage of communities with challenges. So we're working hard to help find solutions and help communities plan, because sometimes the solution isn't a short-term solution. Sometimes it takes a bit of time to work through positioning yourself for what is inevitable in the short and long term. So today I'm going to pass the baton to Sevier, and he's going to do most of the talking. But feel free to put your hand up throughout the presentation, and we'll address anything as we go. And also wanted to say thanks to Brad and Adam for helping us through this, providing information as required. And obviously it's a team effort anytime you do something like this. So, Sevier, if you're ready to go, then
take over. Yeah.
I will have a seat.
Yeah, thanks again for having us. I must say this is one of my first council meetings, so it was interesting to see the sergeant before us and the questions that you guys had for him. I encourage any questions that you guys have as well. Please either feel free to cut me off during the presentation, or we can wait at the end, whatever you guys prefer. So this is our agenda so far for today. We'll go through an introduction of how this project started. I think it was in the spring that Colin and Victoria were over here sort of presenting the first phase of the project, looking at the downtown area. Victoria's on maternity leave right now, so I've stepped in to look at sort of the scope change that came with that, looking instead of just the downtown core to more of a broader geographical area around Liverpool and how flooding will affect those areas. So we've developed maps using some modeling software that we have to figure out the areas that are at risk, and then also to come up with an implementation plan based on priority. Then we look specifically to the downtown Liverpool area. Again, some of the stuff that Victoria and Colin might have presented on in the previous presentation, I think in the late spring. Part of the scope change as well also included looking at the original 1993 report that actually CBCL had completed. And that was also an interesting process for us to be able to dig back those documents and sort of apply modern day techniques that we use for stormwater modeling to that report that was done 30 years ago now. And then in the end, we'll tie it up with some conclusions and recommendations. So I guess this.
Sorry, I meant to ask how long do we have here? I didn't see the agenda.
We would be happy if your presentation was 20 minutes and you took it.
Okay.
10 or 15.
Okay.
There's a lot of content over here. I was sort of practicing this yesterday, and it took me a while to get through it. But I will try to go. As quickly as possible. The project started off with just originally looking at the downtown core, and Queens Municipality hired CBCL for us to look again just at that area around the Home Hardware and that parking lot area. We came up with a couple of recommendations after our coastal analysis of that area, and it was decided upon review of the draft report that we had presented to maybe expand what we would look at. The scope also included looking at the stormwater management plan as well. So I have a few pictures just sort of showing clearly what the problem is. This picture was taken in March 2018 in the springtime. And I actually like the information that's presented over here. This wasn't too long ago. It was the storm after Hurricane Dorian. I think it was on a Thursday, October 17th. There was some flooding in the area over here, and this picture was taken
in the morning, and the table over here is actually the tide chart for Halifax, but it gives a good representation of when we can experience tides. So clearly, we had a very high tide that morning at 9:45 in the morning, and this picture was taken around the same time. So you can see when we have storm surge with a high tide, we're going to experience some flooding issues. And again, this photo taken back in 2012, again showing the recurring problem. This is not a new issue. This photo shows exactly what is wrong over here, because when we have high tide, especially around this downtown core, the water from the ocean sort of backs up into the catch basins in that area, and that really compromises the drainage issues that we have in that area. So we taken all this information, we've talked with our coastal engineers in our office, and they've come up with a couple of tables and a couple of charts and some maps that we'll get into. This table over here shows the return periods, shows the still water elevations for various return periods for 100-year storms, 50-year storms, 10-year storms, so on. So it shows how high the water levels will get based on a specific return period. And so we took this information and then applied it to some of the information that we're coming out of in regards to climate change and sea level rise, and we wanted to see, okay, what does a particular return period mean for a particular projection for sea level rise? And so this information actually came from a tool developed by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, so it's a federal tool, and they have a location specific for Liverpool as well that shows how high sea level will be for different time horizons, all the way down to 2100. So, and this bottom chart then takes the return periods for different storm surge levels and then applies it to the various time horizons. And I know it looks a little bit complicated, but what I really wanted to do with this table was show you how currently, if we have a 100-year storm surge event in 2020, I used these time increments just so that it looks a little bit more rounded, but if we have a 100-year storm surge event, it will result in a 2.4 meter high water level, but that will then just become the normal high water level tide, normal high water level elevation in 2100. So meaning a 100-year storm will yield the same result that just a normal high tide we would get in 2100. So taking that information and using LIDAR information, we were able to project those still water elevations onto maps that can then really show us where the problems are. So this first map shows, these first couple of maps just show the downtown area, but then we've expanded on that to look at the greater, I guess, Liverpool area. And the difference between these two maps is that the first map with the yellow and red show existing conditions for the various storm surge events, whereas this map with the blue, the whites and the blue, show the 100-year storm surge event for different time horizons in the future. There's a number of ways that we could have represented it, but I really wanted to show the worst case scenario with this white and blue map over here. So we took that information, we then divided the community of Liverpool into different regions so that we can prioritize where we want to look at doing the work and implementing changes. And so these are just, again, close-ups of those individual maps. And we have printouts over here, and I think you guys have the draft report as well, so you might have been able to look at that in a little bit more detail. And so this this slide just sort of explains the steps that I used. One of the other things we did was also we created a land use map using information that the engineering department was able to provide us with to determine the various land uses that we have here in the community of Liverpool, whether it's commercial, industrial, residential. That then defined how we prioritized different areas and how we grouped different areas together. We then developed this sort of prioritization technique, which I'll get into in a little bit, but the three parameters we evaluated regions were the level of importance of the infrastructure, so whether it was residential, whether it provided critical services such as the fire hall, the risk exposure, so how risky it was, how prone it was to flooding, and the risk timeline, so how quickly it would be exposed to flooding as well, which would then govern how quickly we may have to act and put in different implementation tools. So we put all that information together, came up with a table, applied different scores to then give us a different priority rank of the different regions. So that table then organized in descending order. It doesn't really tell us something that we don't know. We know that the Liverpool area is probably going to be the highest priority, followed by different other places such as the fire hall, which offers critical services, followed by a mix of commercial and residential areas. So the next couple of slides just look at each region specifically, and we'll loop back to the downtown core after these couple of slides. But the key infrastructure over here, of course, is the Liverpool Fire Station. There's a few residential properties around, but we really wanted to touch on how important the fire hall was over here. And in this map, the fire hall actually isn't in danger, isn't at risk so much, but it's the surrounding area. How good is your fire hall if you're not able to access it off of Main Street over here? Critical services will need to be able to come in and out in order to provide them with the services. The other area that we wanted to look at over here was Mill Brook. It seems that whenever we have a high tide and a spring melt, for example, we do experience flooding, particularly in some of the backyards over here and some of the low-lying areas adjacent to Millbrook. So that's why Region E, the fire hall, scored so highly. Going down the list, we come to the waterfront near Bristol area. Down on Bristol, we find that some of the properties over here, the waterfront properties, are at danger, and of course more at danger as the sea level rise becomes more apparent, but also the surrounding areas near the bridge as well, Lane's Privateerian and Marzi Seafoods. Now I know Marzi Seafoods, they've developed a new area over here, and actually I think they considered for climate change, and if you look at their building, it's a little bit higher, and actually the model shows us that even if you look at the future maps, they seem to be okay where they are over here. Some of their existing infrastructure though, where it's closer to the water, where it's on the dock side, where there's a wharf there, that might be more at risk. And of course the parking lot around Lane's Privateerian, that seems to have some issues over there as well. Now I know this slide looks a little intimidating, but we have to understand what's here. Behind the Sobeys, there is a large wetland, and part of it is we have to understand what the still water elevations are showing us. It really is showing us at what elevation would this be underwater, and of course, with the wetland being there, it just shows up as a giant sheet of yellow. But in the current time horizon, there isn't too much cause of concern because tides would come in, and there is a structure over here on Hank's Hill Drive, I believe, that allows the tides to come in and probably inundate these fields. In the future, that may pose a problem if sea level rise and if the tides continue to rise and rise and rise. We may want to look at having a structure over here that restricts tides from coming in and affecting some of the properties over here.
And it may already do enough now. That's one thing that, you know, it wasn't really part of our study to look at the detail of each spot. But, you know, remember that, you know, tides are on a two-a-day cycle. So, you know, the amount of time that the water would have a chance to get through that limited opening to get to the point where it would get to Sobeys, you know, I think, you know, it's possible, but, you know, I would be skeptical that it would become a real issue. But, you know, you do have a point there where you can slow it down more if necessary. So,
yeah. Drainage may also become compromised over here around, you know, these backyards over areas behind the Tim Hortons and the Sobeys. But without further analysis, we're just not sure. What can be seen, though, is that on the current time horizon, it may not be that much of an issue. Then we come back along on the other side of the bridge, what I'm calling the East Industrial Waterfront area. I believe that Marzi Seafoods also owns this parcel of land over here, but it's more so on the eastern side over here where we see some flooding. Again, not so much to cause too many issues, but still important to recognize that this sort of area over here can be prone to flooding. And then we move further east as well along Main Street again, and we see some residential properties are starting to become affected in this area, particularly I think one or two homes over here. And again, on the future time horizon, we may want to look at those properties a little bit closer. And in my ranking, actually comparing the previous slide to the previous region to this region, if I were to redo things, I think I may have said that this region should deserve a closer look than the other one, just because it seems like you've got Main Street that sort of seems like it may be flooded under certain conditions, but also you have more properties that seem to be affected as well. So a closer look will have to be taken on what we want to do with those affected properties. And the last one's the Trestle Trail. Again, it's I understand it's fairly well used, but in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't pose that much of a problem currently. Future time horizons, yes, there may be some flooding, but it's not going to be the end of the world if the trail experiences some flooding occasionally. So I've taken all of that information. We've looked at the near-term implications, the long-term implications, identified what infrastructure assets would be affected, come up with a priority scale, and then also looked at potential mitigation measures and looked at what those would cost on a very, very high level, just to provide the municipality with some guidance on what they should focus on, what's within their budget, and what they should tackle first, and maybe what they should leave for the future. So I won't go into too much on this table, so if you have questions about it later on, we can certainly address those. So downtown Liverpool, and again, we've Colin and Victoria quickly went over
this. We could definitely save a little bit of time here if we wanted us to kind of revisit what we talked about in March, or we could just blast through this and answer any specific questions that you have afterwards. Yeah, if you want to fast forward through that, a little bit severe.
Right on, yeah. So the seawall, raising grades of the parking lot, and then raising Water Street, as well as a retreat for potential options. So
Yeah, and like you were talking about there earlier, Sevier, you know, the thing to keep in mind is all the different areas, you know, the adjacent areas are obviously linked, you know. You know, one of the things that we thought about while we were looking at potential solutions for this parking lot is you get into the situation where you're chasing, you know, the main road down the coast, and you know, you have to decide, you know, what's really feasible here, and where do you stop? And that's part of the, you know, the background in why we decided to recommend you know, a partial retreat rather than, you know, try to spend a whole bunch of money on infrastructure that eventually will be inundated anyway.
Yeah, and particularly why I like the scope change as well is that if we do decide to move forward with mitigation plans, most of these regions are connected, especially the ones adjacent to each other. So whatever you do in one region, you might have to apply down to the other one, just so we make sure that there's not any gaps for flooding to occur. So the other part of the scope change was to look at the stormwater management plan. Again, as I said before, CBCL had conducted a study and developed a stormwater management plan for Liverpool in 1993. So it was a fun process for us to go dig that up. And we took that information, we took that plan, and sort of gave it an update based on normal and current practices as the industry has clearly moved forward with stormwater modeling, things like that. So we took that information. We also applied and accounted for climate change by increasing rainfall intensity by 30%, which is a common practice to account for, you know, heavier rainfall events, just like maybe how we saw today. Took the 1993 plan. Changed a couple of things, looked at the watersheds, delineated the watersheds, and looked at the modern day IDF curve and came up with this update. So step one, compare the results of the previous stormwater management plan using the previous methodology with current climate and development data. And so we were able to calculate the runoffs for each of these individual watersheds and then compare it to what we would do for the SWIM model, which again is the stormwater software that we use back in the office. So by delineating these watersheds, we were able to then calculate the flows, the runoff flows, and we used the 5-year return period, which is a common practice in order to do that. And in conclusion, we actually found that there wasn't that much of a difference between flows calculated from the 1993 report versus flows calculated now. We thought that there would have been, based on us accounting for climate change and increasing rainfall intensities by 30%. But what we found in the 1993 report was that they actually use a fairly conservative IDF curve for whatever reason back then. So,
and we spent a lot of time hunting for a problem because we thought we were wrong this time. We thought, oh, this can't be right. And anyway, we did chase our tail for a bit, but it was an interesting finding.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing with the difference tables over here, that there really wasn't that big of a change. In some places, yes, with Bog Pond specifically, I guess, but overall, not too much of a change.
So just highlight the key columns there, the difference ones.
Yeah, the
and
difference.
It's important to look at the difference compared to the total, so you can get a sense of the percentage difference.
This last slide sort of talks about low impact development, best management practices for stormwater management. It goes fairly detailed in the report, but these are some practices that the industry, stormwater engineers are sort of trying to push onto different areas that we can. Again, it talks about capturing stormwater on site and on location instead of increasing harder surfaces where the flows will then be a little bit more harsh, a little bit more difficult to deal with downstream. So things like grass whales, permeable pavements, constructed wetlands, all of them have abilities to retain water on site rather than pushing it off onto a different area. And I think we see a lot of that at Millbrook in particular, where there are there's a little bit more of hardscapes in and around that area that increase the flows as it goes into the harbor over there.
Yeah, and I think another consideration there is, you know, long term, as you retreat in some select areas, you know, thinking about what you're going to do with that space. It's not lost space, you know, it could be repurposed just with maybe more resilient things that people enjoy, you know, like parks or I think in the downtown area, the farmers market, that could definitely be something that would be suitable for that area, because most of that's sort of open air structures that are somewhat resilient to high water anyway.
And in conclusion, we do have a recommendation that we limit development below 3.4 meters near geodetic, and that really particularly comes from the 100-year storm surge coupled with the high water large tide in 2100. Those are the levels that we're seeing. If anything that we build now exceeds or is under that amount, it will be at risk of flooding when we come 80 years from now, 2100. So we do provide that one recommendation. And on the prioritization level, we did see that the downtown Liverpool and the Liverpool Fire Hall area, that region in general, are at greatest risk. And while our original scope looked at the downtown area alone, it should probably be expanded to, you know, include probably a little bit more of Main Street, because I feel like whatever solution we decide to go with over there, I think all of those, that whole area is just linked together in terms of a coastal flooding point of view. Infrastructure improvements should account for near-term and long-term risks. So of course, some things are not at risk right now that don't need attention right away. So, you know, you can balance what you want to put your efforts to, whereas what you can leave for a later time. And consider priority in parallel with costs to making infrastructure decisions. So the same thing with that. And for the downtown Liverpool, consider managed relocation of key buildings to higher ground. But there are certainly still some infrastructure options that we have that can mitigate flooding in that area as well. So I think I've rambled a little bit over there. I feel like I've tried to put a lot of information in a small amount of time, but I'm happy to take any questions that you guys might have. So,
Councilor Brewitt.
On that particular slide that we're looking at, you're talking about the Liverpool Fire Hall. Is your concern the actual fire hall, or is it access to the fire hall?
On the current level, I don't believe that there's any risk to the fire hall right now. That's not what our coastal flood maps are showing.
Right.
From flooding, I am worried, again, on the current time horizon, that Main Street on a, I can go back to it as well.
I'm just wondering if it might be useful to bring up the overall map severe for the 100-year horizon.
Yeah, I think so as well.
Do you have your USB stick? Or?
I could bring this.
Oh, you got it
over
there.
Here. Yeah. So on the current level, we can actually see the fire hall over here.
Right.
While it may be surrounded by a sea of red and yellow, the building itself, I don't think, is at risk unless it's a severe condition. Main Street is at risk again at a 100-year storm, but again, these are still water elevations, so the level of water on Main Street may not be that severe. Trucks may still be able to come in and out of that area fairly easily, But it's when we look at the long term, that's when we see some real concerns in that area. So you may have to look at either relocating that or decide to raise it at that location.
I was just looking to see what the elevation of the fire hall was here.
What's the timeline of what we're looking at?
So the 2020 is sort of, I know this map probably doesn't look as clear on the screen over here, but you're probably looking at when the fire hall itself will be affected. You're probably in the 2060, 2080 range, just over here.
I believe that structure is on a slab too, so you know, it's not a dire situation, and you know, a lot of that gear is you know, fairly resilient, but at the same time, you still don't really want your fire hall being underwater.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you've got time.
I'm just surprised that it was number two on that list, you know, compared to the downtown. It seems so obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we see it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
You thought you were surprised it was so high?
So high on the
Yeah,
list.
I think the critical nature of the infrastructure being
right.
being a fire, you know, essential
yeah.
service, is what elevated
Absolutely.
It.
Right.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification.
And just one quick thing: the prioritization and the risk table was just to give a methodology of how to assess these different regions. There was. That was one of the big difficulties of this. How are we going to split regions? How are we going to group regions? Do we look at, you know, a priority table for each individual building across Liverpool? That might be a little bit difficult. So I think in the end that those two, the downtown area and the fire hall, both scored fairly highly, but again, because of the critical nature of the fire hall, that's why it was ranked a little bit higher.
Councillor Johnson? I just got one question, and I might have missed it, but when we're talking about those critical areas in the Region B over by Sobeys, is our sewer treatment lagoon and facility included in the flood opportunity there? Because I would think that would be a high risk for us.
So I actually think on the long term, I actually did not look at the sewage treatment facility too closely, I must be honest. I do know that there is another study that I think CBCL is involved in, looking at treatment facilities that are on the coastal, or located on the coast, and figuring out how vulnerable they are. So that's why I kind of took a step back from looking particularly in that area. I do think that there is some risk there. I'll just go to the big map. In and around over here, right?
Yeah.
There is some risk, I suppose, but I think the bigger risk comes from Hank Snow Drive and that being inaccessible in the long term.
So, you know, I think, you know, one of the follow-ons from this would be to, you know, identify a few key things like this and study them in a bit more detail for those specific areas. Like with the sewage treatment plant, you can see there's a couple of areas there on the top right corner that
In the
longer term horizon, you know, 50 years out, maybe an issue. But you know, what exactly is that, and how is it impacting the function of the facility? You know, that's what would need to be looked at by specialists in that area.
Does that answer?
Yeah.
I would look out for that in the future, though. I do know that there is. A province-wide initiative of looking at treatment facilities on the coasts. I would keep my ears to the ground on
that. Yeah, I think the town of Lunenburg just went through that whole issue.
Yeah.
It should be noted that Hank Snow Drive is much lower than the septic treatment facility.
Yeah, I think we were actually involved. Were we involved in the Lunenburg one? I know there was one recently where we were. Where we were, you know, doing some work in the area, and we identified an issue. Unfortunately, it was kind of in advance, and we were able to actually make some improvements before they were a major problem.
Yeah, and Hankstone Drive is actually pretty important as well, because you have all those pipes that are running running underground over there, and what does flooding mean for, you know, that kind of infrastructure? I do think those are important questions.
Yeah, considering inflow and infiltration, for example, overloading your system potentially, depending on what the infrastructure is like along that road.
Councilor McLeod?
Very interesting information. When you talk about a 100-year storm, is that still the 100-year storm that is considered to be the time frame years ago, or now because we're having storms that are much more sooner? Are you still using those stats, or has...
Fantastic question. I really enjoy that question, because it boils down to the fundamentals of how we actually get these numbers. So the 100-year storm, actually, we get that IDF curve and we get that information from Environment Canada. They are the ones that are continuously updating those curves to account for the storm of recent history. But at the end of the day, it's still a 100-year storm, so that historical data still comes with it. But it does account for the recent storms that we've been seeing that we're saying is occurring more frequently. Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's still a statistical analysis based on what's happened in the past plus what we're expecting in the future. I think you can look at there's a chart on page 6 in the report that shows a few different projections for sea level rise. It's very similar in nature to that, is that, you know, there's going to be a worst case best guess, and then there's going to be a best case best guess, you know, and the reality is it's probably somewhere in the middle, but depending on what you're doing, what are you planning for? Like, are you planning for a fire hall, for example? Well, maybe you want to look at the upper end of that line so that you know that you're going to be safe at any situation. But where maybe you're designing a farmer's market, well, maybe we can go on the lower end of that scale and accept some additional risk if it does flood once in a while and we have a bit of cleanup to do.
And the current situations that we're that we're dealing with are important to address immediately. But when you look at all of the different options for flooding in our most important areas, the ones down the waterfront and all along the coastal area there, from the Liverpool Bridge up through to past the fire hall.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all infilled areas, so I think that has a big impact on the flooding as well, because you do not have that solid, you know,
absolutely,
base, whatever. Is there a possible fix, and you don't want to make a quick fix, but is there a fix with the seawalls and that sort of thing all along there, rather than redoing and expecting buildings to be relocated and the other areas certainly deal with this, and you know, down south, I mean,
yeah,
they have the dikes and they have all those seawalls built. Obviously, they must be working, and so is there a consideration for that first, so that we can do the repair or the mitigation for the situations that were dealt with now in the parking lot?
Yeah, so we looked at that in a fair amount of detail as the first step, and what we found was that if you do create a barrier there, you create a second problem with respect to stormwater. What's happening? Can you go to the stormwater map? So the issue here is that I think it's about from here over to here. All of this stormwater happens to collect in that area,
yeah,
right in that low spot.
Okay.
So if you were to put a wall there, we found that if you did that, you're going to have to figure out a way to get the water out of there if you get a big rain at the same time.
We're not just dealing with seawater, we're dealing with downhill flows.
Exactly. And you know, what we found was that if you're going to do that and you want to truly protect it in all situations, you'd have to have a significant pumping system in that area, which would be extremely costly, and you'd have to create a certain amount of storage as well. So, you know, we found that, you know, to have a viable solution that could work, you'd lose a lot of your parking lot area anyway. Plus, you know, you'd be installing a multi-million dollar pumping system that would need regular maintenance and regular upkeep and still have the potential to fail. So, you know, we thought, you know, our recommendation was based on the fact that, you know, considering, you know, the cost to potentially relocate 10 to 15 businesses primarily, I think, I know there's probably a number of smaller things in there too, but, you know, it was comparable and safer, we thought, to look at that in the long term as opposed to investing a whole bunch of money into infrastructure that that still had challenges. You know, a solution would be quite difficult there. You know, one of the other issues that's going on there is the nature of the parking lot underneath there. You know, we're not sure what's under there. You know, we know there's some old wharves, and we know it's leaky. So, you know, to ensure that you truly do cut off the tide would be a challenge as well.
Brad, did you have a point of clarification you wanted to add?
No, I think we don't. We have one question on the phone.
Yep.
It really speaks to the extent and the margin of flood line limits over time. And I read, when I read the final report, I think it's on page 6, but it basically says that the modeling, what it doesn't take into account is the potential increase in storms as they may occur as a result of climate change. So you can't take these numbers as the strict 1% probability, 1% each 1.5 years. So which is what I was going to just bring up when you mentioned that. So it's the best guideline we have, but there could be an increase in storms that's beyond the climate, the modeling that's based on still water, which may elevate those numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I think fortunately we're in a place in time where there's a lot of effort being spent on this. So we are getting better and better information all the time. You know, the province and the country and the globe, you know, there's a lot of effort being spent on this. So there's, you know, the information is getting better and it's getting updated on a regular basis, which I think is great. But at the same time, it's getting updated on a regular basis and it very rarely goes down. The anticipation for bad things to happen tends to go up the harder you look at it. So, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a best guess, and then you know you have to look at what you've got on a case by case basis and decide, you know, what's the risk and what's your appetite for risk for certain things. You know, with a fire hall, like I was saying earlier as an example, yeah, access is critical. But you know, if it's a fairly new building, you know, and maybe you can operate in such a way that you can minimize your risk at least for the short term, knowing that, you know, maybe 50, 60 years down the road you need to look at a new spot. You know, I think you know, it's an example of something that you really need to evaluate on a case by case basis what the potential risk is before you make a decision and use all the information that you've got at your fingertips.
I would also just like to touch on what Brad said. You're completely right. Like, we're seeing that these events, these 1% of events are having, you know, are occurring more and more frequently. And, you know, we're seeing that in the data. And also the conventional wisdom as well is that maybe we're seeing the same amount of rainfall per year or per month, but the events are becoming more severe and more concentrated, which is, again, a stress on any stormwater management plan or a stress on any town's infrastructure. So I just wanted to agree with you in that sense as well. So.
Thank you. Councilor Fancy.
Yeah, just a few little small things. Where we are today, with the flooding that's transpiring, we can see what's already been being affected. over on the east side of the bridge, where it goes around by lanes and down around, it comes up Mersey Avenue, and we've got four or five people getting flooded every single time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have problems there is that I wonder where insurance is going to be.
Exactly.
Going to say, I'm not going to pay you anymore.
At some point, you're going to get there, and probably sooner than later. I think, you know, that's, you know, one of the things that Brad and I talked about at one point is, you know, looking at buildings to, you know, how could we make them waterproof? Well, we're not that interested in making those kind of recommendations, to be frank, because it's not the best way to deal with it. But it is a way to slow things down for a little while. If you think, you know, you have a new property and you wanna take a crack at waterproofing a structure, and you've got the resources to do that, well, you know, I think, you know, you can, but there's more risk than I'd be comfortable with doing that. I'd much rather pick up shop and invest that money elsewhere. But yeah, it's a tough decision.
It'd be hard to sell your house.
It would be awfully hard to sell your house, exactly, and that's, you know, and that's where I think obviously the municipalities and governments come into play, to a degree, because they set the bylaws and that's why we're recommending setting a minimum development elevation and you know, picking that number and being firm with it and thinking about avoiding getting into those situations in the future.
Can I continue on?